up 17%. Beefsteak up 16%. Fresh fish up 10.6%. Chicken up 8.6%. Pork up 8.3%. No workers beyond a terrible tiny number had wage increases equal to this. Yeah, there's an inflation, and yeah, it's eating into your standard of living. Thank you all for your attention. We've come to the end of today's economic update. And as always, I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, November 21st at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held by teleconference. The call-in number is 623-600-3766. Once again, 623-600-3766. The meeting ID number is 963-003. Everyone is welcome to call in and attend the meeting. Again, the call-in number is 623-600-3766. And the meeting ID number is 963-003. That's November 21st, Sunday, at 1 p.m., the WBAI Community Advisory Board.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Friends and advocates, there is a rally to pass the New York Health Act Saturday, November 20th, 2 to 4 p.m. Uninsured and underinsured, too many have died because they could not afford health care. Families driven to bankruptcy and homelessness to cover medical costs. We demand a better way. Pass the New York Health Act, coverage for everyone, for all health solutions. Saturday, November 20th, 2 to 4 p.m. rally between 124th and 125th Streets on Malcolm X Boulevard. For more info, check nyhcampaign.org or call Earl Kimmick, 646-596-0228.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
The previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, heard Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News. And it's now 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. And once again, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Hello, you're listening to WBAI in New York. It's 7 o'clock time once again for an exciting edition of Off the Hook.
I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood, but they live on.
Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Apologies for the start of the theme in the middle like that. That was unfortunate. And of course, you know, most people like to hear the Off the Hook tone. Let's see if I can make that happen once more. There we go. That's what people want to hear, the Off the Hook tone. So, Manuel, I'm back with Kyle.
Over here.
And hopefully, Rob T. Firefly, are you there?
I am here. Good evening.
Okay, and I believe Gila is with you as well?
I am here too, yes.
And is that Alex I see?
It is I.
Okay, good. Well, this is good. Now, this is progress because we've been away for 5 weeks. We got back. Everything is going haywire. we have a lot of stories to tell. And a lot of things to share, but we might have some technical glitches that could even be milestones for us. It's possible you guys aren't able to hear anything that I play from here. I don't think you're able to hear the theme. Is that correct?
We could not, no.
Okay, so that's unfortunate. So you'll have to listen if we do anything pre-recorded over the air or over the internet or however you do things. We have been traveling across the country. We drove all the way from Seattle, and we went through all kinds of small towns along the way. And it was quite an experience, saw all sorts of amazing things, and have come back with, renewed passion and optimism for the future, because people were really cool all the way through, and there is so much to see and do. And I think the secret is, don't go to the big cities. Go to the small places, and that's where you see more unique things, just interesting people and sights, and a lot of trucks on the highway. What have we missed? What's been going on back here in New York?
Some inclement weather. I think you missed some of that.
Yeah, it hailed.
I heard there were tornadoes.
There were tornadoes, but it hailed in our neighborhood. There wasn't a tornado here specifically, but hail.
Okay, well, if you listened to our show last night off the wall on the other radio station, we had hail, too, while we were recording something. A little bit of hail. Very tiny. It looked like dandruff, but it was hail and frightening. Alex, how about you?
Well, I've been in and out of New York. I've been traveling a bit as well. Not to my usual abode over in Pennsylvania, but I've been... This past week, I was down in Georgia, in Savannah, which is a wonderful city. I had never been there. And also over in the low country of South Carolina, in particular, the Bluffton, South Carolina area, which is absolutely gorgeous. I was over there for work to speak on the subject of cybersecurity at a conference. And it's been interesting. I've been doing, you know, quite a bit of traveling, and also was in Chicago, was in North Carolina, so lots of traveling on this end, but all through planes and not necessarily trains like I know you guys prefer.
Yes, we certainly do. But we did drive, too. We were able to haul a bunch of stuff from Washington State over here to New York. But like I said, we went through smaller places. I'm going to list the places we went through. Just to get a sense as to what kind of travel this was. We stayed in Hermiston, Oregon, Ogden, Utah, Farmington, New Mexico, Trinidad, Colorado, Liberal in Kansas, Henrietta in Oklahoma, Carbondale, Illinois, Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and Morgantown, West Virginia. Yeah. How many of those places have you heard of?
All of them just now.
I think... Yeah, I think I've heard of a few of them. I've heard of Carbondale for sure, and I think what was the West Virginia town again, Emmanuel?
The West Virginia town was Morgantown.
I think I've heard of that as well. But yeah, it sounds like you went to some esoteric places. What were the highs and the lows?
Well, Morgantown. Since you mentioned Morgantown, that was our last stop in West Virginia. Oh, did you fall off your chair there, Alex? Looked like you did. You okay? Okay, you lost your microphone.
No, I'm just.
Wow. Yeah. All right.
I'm using my phone, so you know the video is going to be a little bit erratic.
Yeah,
no, it's going to be like a Blair Witch.
I wasn't
going to
say anything, but boy, Morgantown, West Virginia is a great place. It's a college town, they have this amazing transport system on campus. What are they, Kyle?
PRT, the Personal Rapid Transit.
Personal Rapid Transit. They're basically cars that I guess you can fit about 20 people in, and they're on sort of a track. It's kind of like concrete. How would you describe it, Kyle?
It's a concrete guideway, I believe is what the way you would refer to it, and it has some conductors that run alongside it, and it uses rubber wheels that are sort of angled to follow the curb that's built into the guideway.
It's the biggest one of its kind in the world, if you can believe that. It goes about 13 kilometers. There's something similar at, I believe, Heathrow Airport in London. There's something in South Korea, something in China, but nothing as big as Morgantown. this is the kind of thing that happens when you travel places. You learn things. You see unique displays of one thing or another that you won't find in big cities. So, yeah, Morgantown, personal rapid transit, PRTs. Look it up.
Yeah, and there are little bits of technological interest like that along the way on various infrastructure construction and just seeing how different places are changing and alongside this beautiful terrain. So it's nice to get out there and experience all of that.
Yep. Any other questions?
I mean, I'd heard of about half of the cities you went to, I think, but that's also a function of having grown up in the Midwest.
That's true. You're from the Midwest, every time we travel through either the Midwest or the Deep South, we develop this affinity for it because, I think what we've concluded is the people aren't the problem. They really aren't. It's the crazy AM radio, shock jocks or whatever you want to call them that just spew hatred, or politicians pretty much doing the same thing and just leading people down the wrong path. When you actually talk to people one-on-one, I mean, Carl had an hour-long discussion in a bar with a Kentucky bartender about cars and mechanics and things like that. And that was beautiful to see. And all kinds of similar types of exchanges you can have if you just give yourself the time to do it. And it doesn't have to be at all divisive or anything like that once you establish common ground.
I do have a question, though. Did you take any of the listener suggestions for your route?
Yes, we did.
Lots of them along the way. Yeah, anyone that we could that fit sort of the route that we were on.
Yeah, we went to Mexican Hat in Utah, which is this bizarre rock formation where this massive rock is on top of a much thinner rock. It's kind of like Stonehenge. You can't figure out how it happened. Maybe it was a natural thing, maybe not, but that was particularly impressive because it was so quiet when we got there. We got there just at sunset. Had to drive all day to get there, but we did it. And when we were there, it was like nothing I've experienced. It was so incredibly silent and peaceful. We also checked out what do you call that place in Washington State with the dry falls.
It was like a glacial blockage that was then emptied out and forms this very large deep pit. That was a suggestion from a listener, and we had other ideas of places that were of interest as well that we always kind of wanted to be tourists and kind of in the quintessential way, but never had a chance to. So we fit in a couple of cool TV and film things and even places we just stumbled upon that sounded interesting. That was another real driving factor.
Cadillac Ranch, a listener suggested that. We stopped by there in Texas. And that was kind of cool because we drove across Texas, but when you drive across Texas, it's so big, it takes a full day or more. But we drove across the panhandle of Texas. It's much shorter. It takes about 3 hours. We stopped in Cadillac Ranch in Amarillo. And that's where all these Cadillacs are just, for some reason, it's part of an art project from some artist in San Francisco many years ago. They're just, I think about a dozen of them are just buried in the ground.
Ten.
Is it ten? Okay.
Yeah, there's 10 cars.
And they're spray painted now, too. And yeah, there are a couple of Trump 1 spray painted things on there, but in an hour they'll be spray painted with something else because that's just the nature of it.
So many installations and markers and various points of interest around. So inspiring gets you kind of curious about what else is out there.
Yeah. So again, thanks to all the listeners for suggestions on places to go. It really is amazing. And we're basically logging everything on the other radio show, Off the Wall, which is on Tuesdays and available on 2600.com. So you can hear the audio that we recorded from there as well. But moving on to things that are happening in the world of technology, because that is what we are about here on Off the Hook. We have some hacked police aerial surveillance footage that our good friends over at Distributed Denial of Secrets have released. The activist group has posted over 600 hours of police aerial surveillance footage that was received from an anonymous hacker that claims to target unsecured law enforcement data. Now, distributed Denial of Secrets co-founder Emma Best said that her organization does not know the identity of the hacker or why that person targeted those organizations specifically. A Dallas police spokesperson said in a statement to The Hill that the department had received multiple inquiries regarding a website's report about a potential data breach of 1.8 terabytes of the department's helicopter and drone footage. He said the department cannot confirm at this time how much video information was breached. It is important to note that this video data was not lost, nor is it missing. It's just being shared all over the place. This is an ongoing investigation. The department will provide a full response at the conclusion of the investigation. But basically, I haven't had a chance to really analyze this. And I know you can't link to it on Twitter. If you link to it on Twitter, the tweet won't go through because that's how Twitter is. But there are all kinds of examples of people, voyeurism, for instance, helicopters spying on people, basically First Amendment rights being mocked by cops. I don't have specifics in front of me, but this is what I've gleaned from the reports I've seen so far. Rob, do you know more about this?
Yeah, there's some really interesting stuff coming out of this leak, and it's a huge leak, as we said, almost 2 terabytes of video footage, high-res video footage, and some excerpts from this have started going around. A journalist called Mikhail Thalin, who works at Daily Dot, had a Twitter thread with some highlights. There is, footage of scenes of accidents and things, but footage of just random people who are totally unaware they're being watched by some sort of drone, people sunbathing in backyards, the use of thermal imaging on one of these clips so they could see inside the Mercedes-Benz Stadium during an Atlantic Falcons game. There's more than 600 hours of helicopter surveillance footage that's been leaked to DDoS secrets, and it's really eye-opening if you haven't given much thought to exactly what the police, who are highly militarized, have really expensive toys at their disposal, can see now without any sort of warrants or procedure apparently in any way, and it's really frightening, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also kind of inspirational to see this information just shared like this, because we do have a right to know what is going on by people who wield so much power. It's kind of frightening, but I think it's something that we also need to know. Alex, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is such an interesting development from Distributed Denial of Secrets, you know, whom I feel like it wasn't very long ago we had on the show talking about, I think it was the parlor leaks, I believe. From my perspective, building off what Rob had said, is that you don't realize that the police are monitoring you with this type of technology. They do it from so far afield, being in a helicopter and are able to see where you are or with whom you're consorting. This type of information and the knowledge that this surveillance is possible from the vantage point of a helicopter, I feel like could very much have a chilling effect on First Amendment freedoms, such as freedom of association and freedom of speech. And so in particular, I think we need to be asking a lot of questions about this type of data collection and use, and namely questions like, with what personal data is any of this footage associated with on other police systems? And how is this data, or to whom is this data transferred or shared? Because that, I think, can be very important to know, especially with respect to how long this data is going to exist if you're on any of this particular type of footage. And in particular as well, if there has been a privacy violation, if this technology has been misused, to what extent and how many times has it been misused, and is there any remedy, for a privacy violation from the vantage point of a helicopter, from helicopter surveillance? Because generally, we have seen that the police and police activity have something known as qualified immunity, and the state itself would certainly have a claim perhaps of even sovereign immunity to prevent any kind of liability from arising in the context of a lawsuit. So in as much as this data is super interesting, very neat to look at and watch, it raises a lot of issues and a lot of questions that we should be asking rather rigorously.
And are there any issues involved in hosting this, as distributed denial of secrets is doing? I know Twitter won't link to them, won't allow links to be posted, but, you know, it's easy to get around. You simply put spaces in between the letters or something like that. But that kind of fear of linking to something controversial that somebody's going to get angry about. And we say, you know, quite instinctively, no, we have the right to know this. And I think most hackers do believe that. But Alex, do you see any legal issues that they might be facing by doing this?
Possibly, you know, the hosting of this data from distributed denial of secrets. I mean, look, it's possible that somebody could think that, you know, they are doing something with stolen property, or compromising an investigation, some kind of obstruction. I mean, look, what distributed denial of secrets does on a regular basis is very risky, and they take risks, I think, you know, for the purpose of getting information out to the public. You know, they're performing, I think, what they would perceive in their view as a public service. And there's always going to be a measure of risk associated with dealing with this type of data that is exfiltrated from police departments through an anonymous whistleblower. And I think from the perspective of distributed denial of secrets itself, I would certainly hope that they would not be facing any liability, but what law enforcement is probably extremely interested in is the identity of this whistleblower. And so I think they may be looking down the barrel, perhaps, of some kind of subpoena, perhaps a search warrant that could be executed with respect to any communications with that whistleblower, any data, in particular IP address data that they would have with respect to the whistleblower, which, if you're a whistleblower, makes it all the more important to use something like SecureDrop if you're going to share exfiltrated data with a news organization, or you want to keep your identity anonymous.
And of course, you can see the Distributed Denial of Secrets website at ddossecrets.com. That's with one S, ddossecrets.com. Go ahead, Rob.
And as it says in the name, the genius of how they share this is it's distributed denial of secrets, and these secrets are being shared in the form of a torrent. It's a magnet link, which means that the material is not hosted directly off of this website. It's hosted by everybody who's participating in this BitTorrent-based exchange of information. So if you go to ddossecrets.com and you have an up-to-date BitTorrent client, you can click that magnet link and check this out for yourself. And the torrent was pretty lively last time I looked at it, or so I've heard. And it's sure to be some interesting stuff, and it's sure to be a lot of data to go and grab. You know, you probably need some big hard drives, but it's worth a look. And on the front page there, you have the aerial surveillance footage leak and all sorts of other leaks that that the folks at DDoS Secrets are involved in spreading out there, and it's interesting stuff.
Okay, I want to move to another story of a different note, but sort of the same spirit. This is about a young hacker, very young hacker, 11 years old, and this one who got in a bit of trouble for doing something at his school. We're going to hear his mother. At least I hope it goes over the radio. You guys, I don't think you'll be able to hear it, so you'll have to listen to the radio. But I want you to hear the story as told by his mother, because it's really intriguing, fascinating, humorous, what have you. And we'll be back right after this.
When I tell y'all I've been holding in this story time for the past 7 months, just waiting to tell y'all. Now that everything is settled and done, I'm willing to share this information. But here we go. 7 months ago is April of 2021. Now, I have an 11-year-old, my own child. So during the school year, they were in school 1 week, homeschool the next week, or virtual the next week. So this particular week that he is in school, mind you, they've been having connectivity issues, all this stuff. It's just been a troublesome year. But this is the first year that they have gone, you know, virtual. Things happened, COVID. So anyways, I get a phone call from the school telling me that I need to get to the school to come there to deal with some issues with my child. So they told me that he is not in danger, but he is in major trouble. I pull up to the school. There are 4 police officers, the district attorney's office, the superintendent, the principal, 3 IT technicians. At first, I'm thinking maybe he took the pow-pow to school. Like, maybe he got into my safe. Like, maybe he knows the code, and I don't know that he knows the code. But obviously, that is not the issue here. So I get in there. He's sitting in the hallway in tears. I said, I don't know what you've done, but what did you do? So he would not tell me. He was shaking, very visibly upset. So they told me to sit down. You know, they said, Miss blah, 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 please have a seat. It is a very serious matter. I said, what possibly could my 11-year-old child who is in 5th grade done that has warranted all of this police activity? He's been controlling the internet at the school for the past 3 months. So he was shutting it off, turning it back on when he wanted to. It was to the point where these kids had off school. Their teachers could not email each other. They could not instant message each other. These kids were off school like every other week. And he would come to me and be like, Mom, oh, the internet's messed up. Nobody can do anything. So they let us out early today. And I'm like, wow, they still haven't figured this out yet. Of course they haven't figured it out because it was him. They called in the National Guard to figure it out, and they could not figure it out. So then they had to go through every single computer at the school. Once they narrowed it down to one school, they went through every single computer as these children were at recess and at lunch until they figured out it was him. My child's a criminal. He's a criminal. They wanted to press federal charges on him. Do you understand I had to hire a federal attorney for my 11-year-old? What have I given birth to? Rain Man? If you want him, come get him. I'm giving him away.
Oh, I love it. That is just so incredible. What a great mom. Because you can tell that she is totally supportive of her kid, despite the sarcasm there. But what a story. And a story that I think so many of us are familiar with, the overreaction, the fear, the hostility, and also just the cleverness of a kid figuring something out and just basically controlling technology in ways that adults could never understand. Guys, were you able to hear that? I know you couldn't hear it over the computer, but were you able to hear it over the radio? You were. Okay, good. Any thoughts, comments?
Yeah, I am so happy that the mother seems to see the humor in the situation. Not everyone's parents are would be so generous, and the kid came off lucky there, I think.
Yeah, I think that's so key. If you have a kid who's a bit mischievous, guess what? They all like that. So if he or she is able to manipulate technology in various ways, support them. I'll try to understand what they're doing. Listen to them. Don't join in the mob that's trying to make their lives miserable. I mean, you know, 4 cops and a district attorney at the school. Do you know what that does to an 11-year-old? No matter what he's been up to, had his mother joined in on that, he'd be forever intimidated and not able to express himself or do something creative in the future. Yeah, kids are going to make mistakes. Kids are going to screw up and they're going to make bad decisions. But you know what? The way the technology was implemented, that was a bad decision too. Okay. And I dare say a valuable lesson was learned. And it's just, it's sad that the school couldn't have the same method of dealing with the situation as his kid's mom did. And he's very lucky to have her. I just think of the number of kids who haven't been so lucky, and also the number of kids who have just been through something traumatic like that. Almost everybody I know at some point has been through something like this. And it just makes a world of difference when there's somebody there who can understand and listen. Go ahead, Alex.
I mean, my initial thought on hearing that is, well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And your words certainly ring true, Emmanuel. I mean, I myself remember that, God, it had to be about 28 years ago now, when I was in the public library of my local school district out on Long Island, and I was playing around with the direct access menu system that we had, well, they had put on these DOS-based computers, and I had rebooted the system, Control-C out of the AutoExecBAT, and then modified the AutoExec.bat file to drop me off on a network drive just so I could explore.
You use Control-C,
Alex? They saw me
at
the DOS prompt.
Control-C?
And they, pardon me?
You use Control-C?
I use Control-C.
Oh,
yeah, I know.
I am so disappointed in you. Control-C.
Yeah. Yeah, Control-C out of the AutoExec batch. And, and so there I am, you know, sort of exploring the network, and they had completely freaked out, told me to step away from the computer. And then later on that evening, the police showed up at my house. And, you know, I had to explain to them, well, they didn't let me, you know, change the file back. And then I got a letter to my house claiming I had maliciously vandalized the computer system. And I was just looking around. You know, that's why those computers were there, so people could learn. I was learning. But, you know, it sounds, you know, eerily similar. However, I do have to say, I wasn't shutting down, you know, full internet access to the library. At the time, there was no internet access, I believe, in my local library. But it raises the question, though, to my mind, with what this 11-year-old did. You know, certainly a very precocious individual, somebody who probably has a lot of talent, a lot of curiosity, and that's the kind of childlike attitude towards the world I think that most hackers maintain throughout their lives and should be encouraged. But why on earth can a school not function at all when the internet goes out? And why is there no backup? I mean, that's what's bizarre to me, is that, you know, is it just take a router going down these days to completely cancel school? No, I want, number one, more details as to why there's no fail-safe or backup plan for the internet going out for a school district to function. And number two, I would love to know what it was that this particular 11-year-old did that caused the internet to go out. Was it some kind of DDoS attack? Was he just futzing around with the router? Was he fuzzing the router a little bit? I don't know. I want more details about that.
Then
thirdly...
Yeah, go ahead.
Thirdly... I wouldn't mind being in touch with his mother if she needed to speak with an attorney about this. So I'd be happy to consult with her.
I'd like to have her be the keynote speaker at Hope, but that's yes. that's a whole other topic. But Alex, I'd like to know how you're talking about routers going out and the internet not being accessible and everything being thrown into disarray. That's awfully specific as to what's been going on here. And I just wonder how you happen to know about that, because, you know, all the problems that we're having, it's because of a router that failed, and we have to get another router, and we're having substitute routers, and everything is haywire and crazy. And yet you somehow seem to know exactly what's going on. We're using 2016 speeds here. That's what's going on with us. So we're kind of flailing.
Oh, really?
But, tell me, while we were away, what was going on?
How old is that router?
It's you know, what, 11, 12 years old, 13, more?
Yeah, might be there. Time to upgrade that hardware. Probably, I bet you the firmware hasn't been updated in some time.
Here's the thing. You know, we ordered, I don't want to veer off topic here, but we ordered another router, and we had it overnighted on via FedEx. And you know what? FedEx has canceled their money back guarantee if you don't get a package, let's say you pay for overnight shipping and they don't do it, they're no longer going to give you a refund. So that's what's been happening with us. We have this router that's supposed to be here now. We paid for it to be here in one day, and it's still in Indianapolis somewhere. And we don't know why it's in Indianapolis. It's not here. They keep saying it'll be here by the end of the day. What's the end of the day, FedEx? 11:59 p.m. It's in Indianapolis. It's not going to be here. We know that. We already know that. But the thing that really bugs me is that we can't complain about it. We can't say, FedEx, you didn't give it to us in the amount of time you said you were going to. Will you please refund the money we paid for you to do that? They just said, no, we're no longer responsible. Until the end of the holiday season, we make no guarantees whatsoever. How do you run a business like that? That's what I want to know. So, you know, we could have just not paid for the overnight shipping, and it would have gotten here probably the same time. So, folks, if you're listening out there, don't do that. don't use overnight service. It's really not a good idea. Alex, have you ever heard of anything like that business-wise?
No. No, you find yourself, I feel like, in very unique predicaments most of the time, Matt.
Yeah, well, it's frustrating, that's for sure. But yeah, as far as routers going out and haywire and all that kind of thing, yeah, we're familiar with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's going to continue to happen. I think, you know, no matter what, it's. Time for you to change out that aging hardware. So I'm glad to see that you're on the right track.
Yeah, well, we're trying to be on the right track. It's just a question of getting things to, you know, to show up. Rob, yeah, go ahead.
This kind of connects to the whole story we were speaking about as well, because in schools nowadays, as anyone in information security will tell you, especially institutional information security, schools are still, by and large, speaking very generally, using old equipment supplied by lowest bidders years ago. And so the repercussions for breaching things are all kinds of serious, but the things themselves are old and maybe outdated and maybe not very effectively administrated or protected. And you want to talk about old firmware. There is probably firmware in schools old enough to graduate. And so basically it's an easy target. And you've got a generation of school kids who have grown up with computers since day one and are very good with these things as people go. And yeah, there's going to be breaches. There's going to be mischief. And I think schools need to really examine how they are prepared to deal with that and how they're prepared to deal with clever children.
Yeah, I would just like people to remember that, you know, no one gives us a break ever. They always have their hand out for money and want answers now. And we're constantly at the effect of everything else. And I don't really get a lot of credit for how much we're attacked and how little help we get, you know. And on the defensive, when you're running an operation, you have a lot to contend with, and things can get very chaotic very quickly.
Yes, yes, as they have tonight. But we have an update. We have an update on this story, which I think you guys in our extended studio, you'll have to run back to your radio or to your internet connections. Everybody else, just sit back and listen to this update of the 11-year-old hacker story.
Hey, everybody. We didn't know that this TikTok was going to blow up, but this is the baby genius, as y'all like to call him.
Hello.
My pride and joy. His name is Elijah, and he is a Capricorn. For everybody asking what his sign is, his mother's an Aries, his father's a Scorpio. But anyway, on another note, the outcome of that was that the district attorney's office actually decided to not press charges against him because he's 11 and they did not want to ruin his record. The school was not very happy about that, but it wasn't really in their hands. So next thing that happened was he got recommended to a first-time juvenile offenders program. So
like a computer class.
Yeah, so basically they gave him 5 tasks that he had to complete in order for his record to be wiped clean so that it did not go to court. So he had to build a soccer stadium in Minecraft because he is a captain of his soccer team. He averages 3 goals a game, so that is a thing. So he is in that, you know, sports and things. So then he also had to write an apology letter to me, which it was very well written. I appreciate that. Right. Then he had to do 10 hours of community service. So he cleaned the church with my mom for 10 hours during the summer and did some community events at our local community park. So then what else did you have to do?
And then after that, we found out like we had to do something else.
Oh, so he had to do like a contrast between what would he have done versus what shouldn't he have done and what the outcome of that would have been. So he had to write like a small term paper. Also, they asked him to build his own video game so he could kind of learn the analytics of how that works. And it took him 2 hours to build a basketball game. So he is a little bit of a prodigy. I knew he was smart. I've always said that he's smart. Does he make the best choices all the time? No. But we are working on that. And he is a very good child. Overall, he's a good boy. But I do not tell him every day that he's a criminal. I just said it for the video.
I promise you, he doesn't.
Because it was a crime. Y'all are bugging. And for everybody saying that my makeup makes me look old, I'm 31, but okay. I don't feel like I look old. You know, little shade. I'll be thinking I'll be doing okay. But yeah, other than that, he's a good boy. He likes sports, games. He likes video games. That's his thing. Minecraft.
Rocket League.
Those are his things. He used to play Fortnite a lot, but kind of pulled back on that. But yeah, if you guys want to know anything else, just hit us up. We're working on trying to get him into some better schools. It's just the area we live in. It's not, educationally wise, it's not necessarily the best. So we're working on it.
Okay. And that is the latest. Her name, by the way, on TikTok is Victoria Pretty Much. So, Great story. And, you know, if you're raising kids, it's something to keep in mind. And I know, Alex, you're raising a couple of kids, so you probably know about these types of challenges.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, something about apples and trees comes to mind. And I certainly feel like I'm going to be in a run for my money with my two boys. Going back to the result, though, I think this is a very good result in that the prosecutors declined to press charges here. What they appear to have done is what we would call an ACOD, or an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal. So provided that certain things are done, certain conditions are met, those criminal charges are dismissed. If he failed to do any one of those things, then they could decide to press charges again. I mean, but even that, I feel like might have been, you know, a bit heavy-handed. But it does seem like the tasks that he had to complete were certainly good-natured, and this was a very, I think, positive example of how prosecutorial discretion and declining to prosecute an offense can contribute to an overall sense of justice. And so, you know, I applaud these prosecutors. I think great shame should come to the school district that sought to have the district attorney continue to press these charges and seem to have been disappointed at the fact that criminal charges weren't levied against one of their precocious 11-year-olds. That just doesn't seem like the kind of school district where this type of individual is going to thrive. I certainly hope that you know, whatever school he's in at the moment is fleeting and temporary, and he moves into either junior high or high school and gets a new administration that can deal with him. And hopefully he's going to be taking some advanced placement computer science courses and brushing up his programming skills soon enough. He sounds like a great kid who's got a bright future ahead of him, and I'm really glad to hear about this result.
Gila, go ahead.
I absolutely agree with Alex, and I think also the fact that the consequences that he had were not punitive, and they were not something that was going to, you know, he didn't have to write, "I will not mess with the school's internet 10,000 times. He got to do things that helped develop his skills and made this something to look back at as a turning point in perhaps a positive way, and were not something that's going to anger and traumatize this kid any more than already has. And I think this is a really creative way that the consequences were provided. It was supportive and positive, and yet there were still consequences for having done this thing. But I think this was really, the consequences themselves, I think, were really handled well. And also, yeah, thrilled that they did not press charges against an 11-year-old for those.
But again, as Alex pointed out, the school wanted to. The school wanted to come after him more. And I think that's extremely unhealthy and detrimental to any kid to treat them like a common criminal when we're talking about a bit of mischief. And yeah, it might have screwed them up, but you know what? They were screwed up the moment that network was put online because they clearly didn't know what they were doing. And, you know, now they have someone who can teach them. So they should be feel lucky that they have that. But that's just not the way to treat kids. That's just not the way to have them learn a lesson. And I wish more schools learn that themselves. But, you know, over the years, I've seen it happen over and over again where the reaction to any indiscretion is just over the top. And kids pay for it for the rest of their lives. They're thought of as bad, as criminals. And I was very happy to hear her say she's not going to call her kid a criminal, even in jest, because that kind of thing can stick with you.
Definitely a cool mom.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So let's move on then. We have some sad news to end on. We've kind of known this has been coming for a while, but there was an article that came out in an online publication called Untapped New York. It came out yesterday. It's called "Say Goodbye to the Hotel Pennsylvania Demolition. Preparations are underway." Hotel Pennsylvania is slated for demolition. The ornamental building, built in 1919 and designed by McKim, Mead, and White, sits across 7th Avenue from Penn Station. It's owned by the evil people at Vornado Realty Trust. I added the evil people part. Who has begun removing mattresses and furniture in preparation for the physical demolition of the building in January 2022. The Hotel Pennsylvania is home to the Café Rouge, which at the time of its opening was the largest and most exquisite hotel restaurant in the world. In the first half of the 20th century, iconic American musicians such as Duke Ellington and Glenn Miller performed at the Café. During the second half of the 20th century, the hotel, which began to show its age and dropped its prices accordingly, offered affordable rooms to students, writers, artists, and dreamers who came to New York with, as E.B. White once wrote, a manuscript in a suitcase and a pain in his heart. In many ways, the Hotel Pennsylvania is the embodiment of the aspirations of New York in the 20th century. This is not the first time that Vornado has tried to demolish the Hotel Pennsylvania, as all of us know. They bought the building in 1999. And announced plans to demolish it in 2006. And then we stepped up and helped save it for about a decade or so. In its place, they wanted to build a glass skyscraper that approached the size of the Empire State Building. The 2008 recession put their plans on hold. And in 2013, Vornado announced that they wanted to restore the historic structure and bring it back to its 1919 glory. Now they are reneging on that promise by claiming it is too expensive. Demolition is planned to start in January 2022 as part of a larger mega project to raise multiple blocks and historic buildings from 31st to 34th Streets along 8th to 6th Avenues. The mega project is called the Empire Station Complex. It was the brainchild of former Governor Cuomo, who wanted to turn the area around Penn Station into a modern office hub akin to that of Hudson Yards. And even though the project is entirely in New York City, which has its own land use process called the Uniform Land Use Review Process, otherwise known as ULURP, the development plan is being implemented through New York State's General Project Plan, known as GPP, which has been criticized in the past for subverting community input. Coincidentally, much of the land to be rezoned for luxury office towers is owned by Vornado, whose CEO, Stephen Roth, was Cuomo's largest campaign donor. The Empire Station Complex has received intense local opposition from over a dozen organizations, city and state elected officials, and some of the non-Vornado landowners in the redevelopment area. In response to New York State's current plan, the Empire Station Coalition, in conjunction with Rethink New York City, has put forward an alternate plan that would preserve most of the existing streetscape, rebuild the original Penn Station, a train station rivaled in beauty only by Grand Central, and modernize the station's tracks and platforms to convert it from a terminal into a Tokyo-style through-ring station. In the coming months, as New York emerges from the COVID-19 pandemic, the outcome of the battle over this $7 billion project won't just determine the fate of a large swath of the west side of Manhattan and the busiest train station in the country, but the fate of the entire New York region's transportation and development. And again, that story from Untapped New York, written by Max Scott, sums it all up. And there are pictures there as well. You can go to untappedcities.com to see them, of mattresses in the street, just what they're doing with the hotel right now. We passed by it a few days ago. And Kyle, they had notices on the doors about asbestos, I believe.
Yeah, that kind of coverings and notices, basically, and plywood over everything. And I think one of the street level places was still advertising like a space for lease, which seems unlikely.
Yeah, it's so sad to see this, and to realize that. They took advantage of the COVID pandemic to shut it down, because this was a hotel that was always full, always host to travelers from all around the world. Now, people in New York City, yeah, you don't really need a cheap hotel because you already live in New York City and you presumably have some place to go. But people from around the world, they would always flock to this place, as we know from our Hope conferences that were held there. And it was just a great introduction to New York City, right across the street from Penn Station. And you just have to wonder how many people will not come to New York City now as a result of that place not being there. Do we really need more office towers? These are the same questions we asked back in 2008. It's just really unfortunate and I think corrupt as hell. But there's it doesn't appear to be anything that we can do at this late stage. Alex.
Yeah, I'm wondering about a lot of things with regard to this news. First off, the plans to build more office towers and office space in a post-pandemic world where office space may not be at such a premium, may not be needed, and there's going to be a lot of empty office space in and around Midtown, seems like, you know, perhaps these plans are not very well conceived, number one. Number two, if you think about the battle that the Strand Bookstore had with respect to the Landmark Preservation Commission landmarking their building, and the tenacity with which the Landmarks Preservation Commission in New York pursued the landmarking of that building. If the LPC itself had pursued the landmarking of Hotel Pennsylvania, I would, you know, venture to say with even one quarter of the verve and steel that they had with regard to the Strand, and this building could have been saved.
Yeah,
this
considering
historical hub of New York culture could have
considering
been saved.
How many
what the
people,
hell is the Landmarks Preservation Commission doing with their time?
Considering how many people were urging them to do just that, and with the case of the Strand, I don't think anybody was urging them to do that.
Right.
Yeah, again, corruption, and it's just a damn shame because it's such an incredible structure, such history there. You can't replace that. Once it's gone, it's gone. Rob, quickly, we're down to our last minute.
Yeah, and it really bears looking at how they're using GPP to make an end run around the community that would have a voice in what goes on in their own community. They did the same thing a few years ago when Amazon tried to barge into Queens and put up a building nobody wanted. And, you know, the GPP were doing all they could to try and get Amazon that deal with the city. And the uproar was finally too much for them. But that's who knows what's going to happen in this case.
All right. Overtime is back at 8 o'clock. Go to our YouTube channel 2600, or just follow the link on the top of 2600.com and join us. You can call us and be a part of the dialogue. Write to us, OTH at 2600.com. And for the last time, maybe, let's take a good listen to this piece of history. See you next week or at 8 o'clock. Your choice. Good night. Pennsylvania 6, 5,000.
Hotel Pennsylvania. We are permanently closed. For human resources, please press 1. For finance, please press 2. For general information, please press 3. Thank you.
Pennsylvania 65,000.
November 8, 2021 is the notice date to proposed Pacifica bylaws amendments. The proposed amendments may be found on the Foundation's website at www.pacifica.org for review. Votes by the Pacifica National Board and the various local station boards regarding said amendments will occur thereafter.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Friends and advocates, there is a rally to pass the New York Health Act Saturday, November 20th, 2 to 4 p.m. Uninsured and underinsured, too many have died because they could not afford health care. Families driven to bankruptcy and homelessness to cover medical costs. We demand a better way. Pass the New York Health Act, coverage for everyone, for all health solutions. Saturday, November 20th, 2 to 4 p.m. rally between 124th and 125th Streets on Malcolm X Boulevard. For more info, check nyhcampaign.org or call Earl Kimmick, 646-596-0228.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, November 21st at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held by teleconference. The call-in number is 623-600-3766. Once again, 623-600-3766. The meeting ID number is 963-003. Everyone is welcome to call in and attend the meeting. Again, the call-in number is 623-600-3766. And the meeting ID number is 963-003. That's November 21st, Sunday, at 1 p.m., the WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting.
WBAI Join us on November 26th to December 12th at Cinema Village, Sinopolis, and virtually as we celebrate 29 years of the ADIFF, the film festival that always brings you great films about people of color all over the world. Discover over 70 entertaining and revealing fiction and documentary films, including 38 world, U.S. and New York premieres. The African Diaspora International Film Festival from November 26th to December 12th. For tickets and schedule, go to nyadiff.org or call 212-864-1760. That's 212-864-1760. Enjoy your world on the big screen.
8 p.m. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Tuesday night, time for Michio Kaku with Exploration.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. Well, today we're going to talk about a controversial issue that many scientists don't want to talk about, and that is what happens when scientists create evil. What happens when they collaborate with the Nazis to unleash incredible amounts of destruction, even though they themselves may have had good intentions and some of their work opened up whole new worlds to science? We're going to be talking about two individuals today that shaped the 20th century. The first is Wernher von Braun, the greatest rocket scientist of all time, the man who was responsible for putting men on the moon. However, he started off his career working for the Nazis, perfecting the V-2 rocket, the terror rocket which terrorized London during World War II. He was captured by the Allies and then worked for the United States, building the Apollo space program, which was successful in terms of opening up the world, the universe, for space travel. And in the second hour of Exploration, we're going to talk about a much darker side of working for the Nazis. We're going to talk about Fritz Haber, one of the greatest chemists of all time who also worked for the Nazis. However, much of his work was later used for chemical warfare, and it's ironic that the gases that he perfected, including zyklon gas, was eventually used to gas his own relatives. So in other words, here is a tragic case of a scientist, Fritz Haber, who opened up whole new areas of chemistry. In fact, he made modern fertilizer possible. Think about it. In the old days, nitrogen in the air could not be fixed into chemicals that could be used for fertilizer, even though bacteria can do this. He was able to perfect the process by which we can take nitrogen from the atmosphere and create fertilizer for it, and that in turn helped to create the Green Revolution. So on one hand, the German scientist Fritz Haber opened up the modern world of fertilizer, which created the Green Revolution, which greatly expanded the human population, and yet he also worked on poison gases for the Nazis, which were later used to gas his own relatives. So the theme of today's program is scientists who have to take responsibility for the achievements and also the dangers that they unleash on the world. So once again, our first special guest is Michael Neufeld. He's with the National Space and Air Museum of the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., and he's the author of the book Von Braun, A Dreamer of Space, Engineer of War. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Daniel Charles, author of the book Mastermind, The Rise and Fall of Fritz Haber, the Nobel Laureate, who launched the Age of Chemical Warfare. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Neufeld. He's the chair of the Space History Division of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And he's the author of an exciting book. It's a huge book. It's perhaps the definitive biography of one of the pioneers in the exploration of outer space, Wernher von Braun. If you are a baby boomer, you probably were mesmerized by the image of this handsome scientist pointing the way to the stars with Walt Disney, saying, "On to the moon." And, of course, he was successful that in his lifetime, he saw his childhood dream come true when he was responsible, in part, for putting several men on the moon. So once again, our special guest is Michael J. Neufeld of the Smithsonian Museum. The book is titled Von Braun, Dreamer of Space, Engineer of War. And it's also a book that forces us to confront the fact that how do we deal with scientists who work closely with the Nazis? So why rocketry? Rockets were thought to be the stuff of science fiction and toys. Why did he seize on rocketry?
You know, it was right in the 1920s that the space movement took off for the first time and reached the general public. It was because of several theoreticians. One of them was Robert Goddard in the United States. Another was Konstantin Tsiolkovsky in Russia. And then in the German-speaking world, Hermann Oberth. And in 1925 or the beginning of 1926, he already enthused by astronomy, got a hold of Oberth's rocket treatise, The Rocket in Interplanetary Space. And even though he couldn't understand it because it was all full of mathematical formulae, he was extremely excited about the idea that you could actually travel there.
Okay, now very soon he becomes head of the rocket program for the government. Exactly how was the transition done? Here we had this young kid getting interested in engineering and rocketry, and all of a sudden he becomes a pro. What happened?
Well, it's an interesting thing. Of course, it takes a number of years here, about 6 or 8 years from the time that he discovers Oberth. You know, he goes to boarding school. His math grades, which were terrible, become much better because all of a sudden he's motivated in math and science and becomes a kind of prodigy. He graduates early in 1930 from high school, goes into engineering school in Berlin, and at the same time he was a member of the Early Rocket Society in Germany, and they built a rocket center in Berlin. And this so-called Raketenflugplatz, this rocket club in Berlin, was beginning to experiment with rockets after 1930. And in 1932, the Army, which had already been watching this, got interested again in the rocket as a weapon. The rocket, maybe the liquid fuel rocket that these clubs were developing might actually be useful for a long-range weapon.
Now, 1933 is the pivotal year where Hitler takes over, which changed everything. So how did von Braun deal with the Nazi regime?
Well, you know, von Braun at first almost, as he says, paid almost no attention to this change of power, except for the fact that his father lost his job, because in fact his father had been the Minister of Agriculture for the German Reich in the last two very right-wing cabinets before the Nazis came to power, and was out of a job on the day that Hitler became Chancellor. So the Nazis came to power, and they were very rapidly destroyed the Weimar democratic system and established a dictatorship. But he wasn't that interested in all that, and in any case, you know, pretty rapidly they began funding the army better and better, so more money came towards him and came towards this little rocket program. At that time, just a couple of people, including himself.
Okay, and then what happened in the 30s as more and more money came available, and which led to the development of the V-1 and the V-2 rockets?
Well, in the 1930s, more money was given to rearmament, and there were people in the Army, notably General Becker, who became the head of the Army Ordnance Department, who was extremely interested in the long-range weapon and the rocket, what we now call ballistic missile, was an exotic long-range possibility. And so he began putting more and more money into rocket development. That led in 1937 to the founding of a new rocket center at Peenemünde on the Baltic Sea, and von Braun, who'd already built up a liquid fuel rocket program, then became the technical director of this rocket research station on the Baltic.
And how old was he when he assumed the head of this rocket program?
He was 25 years old. He wasn't the head. He was a technical director, and the head was a military officer always. But he always was the technical head of this rocket development. And he worked for the Army, but the rocket station was actually a collaborative effort between the Air Force and the Army. And he was the head of the Army side, which went on to develop what was later called the V-2. That was the ballistic missile. They called it the A-4. It was the fourth one in their series, which became the weapon deployed at the end of the war. The V-1 was actually a completely separate weapon that he did not develop. Mm-hmm. That was a cruise missile. It was essentially a small jet airplane, which the Luftwaffe or Air Force developed during World War II.
Okay. Now the question is, how did he deal with the Nazi regime? Was he aware that slave labor was used to build these gigantic rockets?
Well, you know, he was, of course, quite aware of what was going on. In 1937, they asked him to join the Nazi Party, so he said, well, okay, why not? In 1940, the SS came and pressured him to become an officer, and he asked around, and they said, I couldn't really say no, and that was partly because he didn't really have any strong moral principles other than furthering his career and, above all, going into space is what he really wanted to do. And then in 1943, the problem came up, how are we going to assemble the V-2 and who is going to do it? And there was a real manpower shortage because of the Eastern Front. And so the decision was made by others to use concentration camp labor. And then the last phase of this, and the worst of this, is that they went underground in the fall of 1943 because of an air raid on Peenemünde by the Royal Air Force. And that's when the really horrible conditions for concentration camp labor set in. And at that time, von Braun was underground. He saw the concentration camp laborers. He saw the conditions. He was involved in decision-making about using concentration camp prisoners, which means that he certainly couldn't say that he bore no responsibility for it.
Okay. Now, he wasn't the only one in that position. That is, top scientists who worked with the Nazi regime, Werner Heisenberg, the man who was in charge of the German atomic bomb program, was in a very similar situation. And so the question is, were these people Nazis at heart? Did they simply join the regime and work the regime because they wanted to further science? Was it careerism? Exactly. Why did they collaborate, in fact, work and head up large parts of the Nazi war machine?
Well, in the case of Heisenberg, he was never a member of the party. He managed to evade doing that. I think both of them were fundamentally came out of very conservative backgrounds, conservative families that were nationalistic. And therefore, they felt that they were working